it was all a pipe dream, watching bodyboarding up on TV. Deep at reef, watching tension repeats, eating bakery feeds at 18, living the dream with no sunscreen. Yeah, we were so keen, surfing Aussie pipe, buying Riptide, eating shit pipe.
Alright, g'day, welcome to the Riptide Bodyboarding Podcast, the home of bodyboarding. Thank you for joining us on episode 79 of our verbal journaling, and I'm your host, Luke O'Connor. Well, today we're perched up in my second son's bedroom with one of my oldest friends. We have travelled Australia and the world together at times, experiencing some very, very, very extreme highs and some catastrophic lows, let's put it that way. He's an absolute freak behind the lens when it comes to photography and cinematography. He's made his way through the world through that skill set. He's worked on some of the biggest projects we've seen in the last decade. He's a real go-getter. He's a man that doesn't leave any stones unturned. He's also a man that possibly leaves things to the last second, but works well under pressure and just gets the job fucking done. He is an inspiration. He's a good egg, and I'm so stoked to have him in my house. Steve Wallbrother, thanks for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having us, Lou. Yeah, it's been an adventure over the years, hasn't it?
It's definitely been an adventure. I can remember the first time I think we were together on a trip away would have been our first pilgrimage to Hawaii.
Well, wait, Sutherland train station.
Yes, it was Sutherland.
Was that the very first time?
I think it was, yeah. Banging out blue lines at Sutherland station.
Yeah, wow, man.
I know. How long ago was that?
That was 2009 or 10.
Fuck.
2010, I think.
Crazy. So it's been, 14 years.
And that was an eventful couple of days.
It was. Yeah, let's quickly run through that, eh? Like, so we met at South Coast train station. You came over from the Northern Beaches.
I think Maddie Young connected us.
Yep. And the first trip was to hop in the car and drive 25 hours across Australia for no goddamn reason.
Yeah, just for a bit of fun.
Yeah. Well, it definitely was for a reason, but at the time it was kind of like, you know, to our parents at least, or especially to mine, we're like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, like people just don't do that. Normal people just don't do that, right?
They don't. And I reckon even to this day, like when you speak to younger groms and tell them about the hours spent behind the wheel, it's probably not accustomed to do that anymore. But at the time, that's what bodyboarding was. It was the chase. It still is to a certain extent, but very much there and then.
Yeah, and you pile four blokes into a four-cylinder vehicle of some variety and hit the highway. That's how it works.
I know. Four-cylinder box motor. It was the XS Forester model at the time, Subaru Forester. And what an eventful time. That was my green one, wasn't it?
Yeah, here for a good time, not a long time.
Yeah, and we certainly at about the 18, 19-hour mark were probably looking at being here for a good time, not a long time, because those words echoed in my ears as we were doing our third somersault, so to speak, or side somersault, as the car was cascading down a ditch after veering off the road just outside of Renmark in the New South Wales South Oz border.
Yeah, and we walk away without a single scratch.
Can you believe that?
Four dudes in the car.
That?
Gear everywhere.
Mate, and you were sitting next to a fella that refused to wear a seatbelt. Another young recommendation that just came out of the woodworks.
Yeah, those youngie recommendations. Oh my God.
Mate, they've got better over the years, but fuck, at the start, he's thrown a couple of spanners in the work. For good measure, though, because Greg Fraser was an absolute legend.
Yep.
He just was completely different to anything we'd experienced at the time. And he refused to wear a seatbelt, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, that's just, I don't really know what to say about that, but we got away with that one.
Oh, mate, I can remember looking back in the rear vision mirror as we were somersaulting, and there were like, you were locked in holding on. There were pelican cases flying everywhere, and Fraser was somehow still calmly seated in the middle, just going with the flow. Andrew Hoff was in the front, like spilt his like third can of Dr. Pepper and was just trying to rewind the footage of that fucking eagle he showed me.
Scrolling the menus of his Sony Handycam.
Yeah, yeah. Going back over the tapes and hopefully he hasn't like filmed over the original footage that he had on there already,
yeah.
Which we've all seen and heard of. And yeah, like to do that And to have that happen on the trip, it's kind of amazing that we are still here today, because that is a severe car crash that probably could have ended our lives.
Yeah, 120Ks an hour, three fishtails down the road, an ARS, like multiple rollers into an ARS.
Yeah. Probably would have got move of the trip, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anything bigger than that went down.
You don't even need a Monty's bowl.
Even though we hightailed it quickly to the coast.
Yeah, I couldn't.
Despite that.
I couldn't believe that turnaround. So we have the crash, right? This is our first trip to South Oz, 2010, I believe it was, because my first time in 2009. And we're going over there. We don't really know each other that well. And we've obviously, you know, like bodyboarders and surfers, you all gel together on a trip because you go through hard times and challenges and whatever. And I remember us pulling together after, like, you know, all the shit talk and ridiculous videos that were taken after, like, me being an arrogant little piglet and, like, thinking it was all good after I'd almost all kill you guys, like, whilst driving, like, almost took three people's lives, including my own, and then had to ring my mum and dad, classic entitled Western, you know, little shy boy, calling back to mum and daddy to inject more cash into the account. And this wasn't physical cash, it was more so an insurance claim that allowed through their gold NRMA membership to us to get hightailed back to Adelaide, where we then got a bus to Adelaide, which was all paid for. We got a hire X-Trail for free. We just had to pay the fuel, obviously. And we did a turnaround from Adelaide. I think we got it at like 8 or 9 at night.
Oh, and we learned our lesson and then drove through the night again to get to the...
Because we knew the swell was hitting that day and we were like, Monty's could be on here, let's go. And that was it. Yeah, we went all the way over and bam, we were just locked in and the rest was history.
Yeah, fond memories of those young days on the Bull where it's just like, all right, you know, this has happened, but, you know, what's next? Let's keep going.
And that's what it was, eh? It was just what's next. It didn't seem like much would faze us. And I think that's the essence of bodyboarding in a way, because, you know, you look at a lot of different action sports around there, you know, mainly to our bigger brother surfing, and it doesn't seem to have that much of a chase tag on it, you know what I mean? Like, don't get me wrong, there's some really, like, you look at Torrin Martin and you look at, like, even Dylan Graves, for example, like, finding all those weird and wonderful novelty waves around the world. Like, the travel and the chase is there for certain people, but most three-fin shortboarders just want to fucking be told the conditions, turn up, almond latte in hand, and just get on with the job, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's the adventure that teaches you the resilience, and it teaches you to go with the flow, and I think booging just gives you that in spades.
For sure. Do you reckon that's why you've gone so far within your career? Because, you know, you've done some ridiculous shit, really. Like, I remember you going out, I hope the Maritime isn't listening to this, but you going out well before dawn on a PWC and shooting flash photography all up and down the coast at 10 to 12 foot pits by yourself, where most crew would think twice about that. And that's only one of the escapades you've been on that has kind of shone through as, like, you going up against challenging conditions and succeeding. Do you feel like bodyboarding gave you that platform to start on?
I think booging definitely pushes you to be resourceful in the way of, you know, you're not doing it for some kind of recognition, you're not doing it for money, you're just, I guess it's like very authentic. And I think if you follow that into other things, you know, it can take you very far. Like, if you take the approach that you apply to booging and you do well in that, if you take that into the legitimate film production world or the adventure world or whatever, it's all the same skill set. So I think, I mean, I'm great, really grateful actually to have had the booging upbringing, because then suddenly when you go and do things and there is support and there is resources, it all just feels a lot easier.
For sure, because you've gone through it like almost just shat out of the asshole of, like, water sports. You know, you've come out the harder end of it, you know, in like a watery, gloopy mess, but you build your way up from there, and then you can get to the shoulders or the top of the head of the water world, or like water leisure world, so to speak. Because really, like, when you look at your career, Wally, you were always known at the start as the boog photographer. Like, you've been bodyboarding for ages, but you moved to boog photography. You always had an amazing skill set for that. You started getting features in like Riptide and Movement and the Boogie in so many magazines. You got covers. You were start getting sent on trips. you were the go-to guy, and then you moved to videography and cinematography, and you transferred from bodyboarding after we all, you know, the world document GFC and how it kind of crashed and burned, so to speak, and there was no money for you creatives in there. And then you've transferred the skill set in which you learned from bodyboarding over to action sports all around the world. Like, crazy kind of journey right there.
Yeah, I mean, crazy pathway, but I suppose it's still, it feels like the same process in a way. You know, it's honing in and it's chasing something, and often just something that, you know, you really believe in. And I think that's nowadays, that's where it's kind of gone full circle in. I really get a lot of reward, I guess, out of getting out in nature and in wild elements and being amongst it and trying to show that to the world. And to me, it doesn't feel that different to when you would obsessively pick the eyes out of a swirl and go and drive up and down the coast, you know, all day, doing whatever was kind of there for you.
For sure.
But I guess it's an unpredictable thing where you're just going with the flow and doing your best with it.
Yeah. And you've always lived that, your life that way, like pretty fluid, pretty spontaneous, pretty just drop the hat, let's do this and do that. Like, do you feel like you thrive off that adventure seeking side of your role in the world?
I mean, I find it really rewarding. Like, I would say that being out and being amongst nature, and I think whatever it is, if it's in the mountains or in the ocean or whatever the place is, I think that's just what I find the most rewarding. So, yeah, whatever I'm doing there, that's kind of my happy place.
Yeah, away from fucked up society.
Well, it's a bit easier to figure out than society, isn't it?
No true words, definitely a lot easier.
In a way. So I think there's just a great presence out there in those places as well.
Yeah.
And that's therapeutic.
For sure.
You know, which is precious nowadays.
Yeah, it is, yeah, especially like in everyone piled upon themselves in on top of themselves in cities and yeah, you've got to earn a dollar here and a dollar there and whatever. It's cool to have a job in society or a pastime or just, you know, a hobby, leisure activity that allows you to connect to those. And like, you know, your time behind the lens and out in nature is kind of all of those things in one, really.
Yeah, I guess there's a strange kind of conflict there in like work and play being the same thing.
Mm.
But I can live with that.
Definitely, yeah, for sure. The benefits come up and I guess also the disadvantages sometimes, but yeah, crazy, man. Let's take it back to square one, because, you know, you've started your humble beginnings in the Northern Beaches. Your parents are still there now. You know, it's a special part of the Australian East Coast. And what made you, especially in quite a surfing-centric part of the coast, want to choose bodyboarding?
I mean, Monavel Rip Bowl, say no more.
Tristan Hogan, shout out.
Yeah, Tom Ditchfield, Hogs, yeah. Harry Sarin.
Mmm. I haven't heard that name in a long time.
My mates that I surfed with, you know, legends. And then, of course, the older guys that, you know, were well and truly entrenched in the boog scene. And Monavel was a hub for the sport. When I was growing up, it was the thing to do. And that little right-hander in there was just always good.
Yeah, really? Was there a couple of years there where just you can remember sand build up for days and you would never have to leave the little hub?
I mean, you know, when you look back and you don't know if it's hindsight and you're going, oh, I remember when that wave was so good, or if it actually was that good.
Mm.
I think everyone can probably relate to that thought.
For sure. I relate to that at the island all the time. Yeah. I have issues with it because I sometimes think to myself, was I just imagining how good the waves were because of my lack of experience in the ocean and seeing what really good waves are, or was I just like so nostalgically riddled that like I just wanted to be immersed and my froth levels were so high that I didn't care what the conditions were, so to speak. Every surf was a good surf.
Yeah, like was the experience imprinted in your mind so powerful and so strong then that nothing can compare
now, in a way.
And I think there's a little bit of that going on with Motivel. You
know, yeah.
I remember just days, it's 3-4 foot waves, but just your friends out.
Yeah.
You know, little moments of magic. And yeah, that was a big part of booging for me. It was the thing to do.
For sure.
And I didn't really pick up surfing until a few years later.
Yeah. So you bodyboarded from what age?
14 or 15. I think I kind of got into it.
Yeah.
And I spent a few years kind of figuring, I was pretty scared of the ocean. like really scared of the ocean when I started, you know, and waves over 2 foot freaked me out. And I think when I realized I was a pretty average booger and I had mates who were quite good, I went, oh, maybe the camera is the way. So I get to come on the adventures, I get to be a part of it, and I can kind of tippy-toe my way in from the sidelines into kind of scarier water.
That's so crazy to hear you say that, though, because I'm just in my head going, like, you don't seem scared. Do you know what I mean? I totally get how you would be at the start. Like, you know, big waves, and when you're younger, growing, we're all, like, nervous and scared and you, the anticipation of what's going to happen and whatever. But to where you sit now in the world, like, you seem like you'd happily paddle out like 15, 20 foot waves and just bob around in the ocean. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying you'd be out there just towing into waves, but you seem very comfortable in your surrounds.
I mean, I was scared when you and I were surfing at Cape the other day.
Were you?
A little.
Wow. Yeah. You seem to hold yourself so well.
A little bit.
Yeah.
New waves, intimidating waves.
But you were straight off the plane into that. That was a good score.
Yeah, I mean, it had to be done, right? You don't mess around when the ocean's like that.
No.
On the East Coast.
Yeah, you came in at a really nice time. Like, that was that south swell that had just lingered for the whole week. We'd only just run the challenge and it just kept pulsing.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually trying to get back a few days before, but I couldn't do it with commitments on the other side and flight changes and all of that.
Well, you're a long way away.
Long way away, and it kind of worked out pretty good.
Yeah.
I think in the end, I watched the crazy stormy days go, and then I flew in, and it was 6 to 8 foot and stiff offies all day.
I know.
Unbelievable.
You've come home with a beautiful run of weather because we've had a bit of rain here and there and whatever, and there was a really rainy period maybe 6 weeks ago, but classic winter conditions at the moment, just blue skies, offshore winds, water's still warm enough for it to stay offshore for a fair while with the land not heating up and not getting too hot. It's like a perfect time to roll out the red carpet and have you come home.
It's a bit nostalgic, isn't it?
This time of year,
like deep blue ocean and westerlies and all of that.
Air quality pretty good for smoggy Sydney.
Yeah,
it's
crisp and clear all day.
It's delicious. So, you know, with your bodyboarding then, moving from Mona Rip Bowl Man and you're picking up the camera and kind of progressing that way, when was the first time that you felt like you went on a proper professional trip?
It's a good question. I think it all happened pretty fast, really. The whole thing with the camera is it felt like you were rewarded. You were, like, incentivized to chase it, I guess, as hard as you could. And when you're a young kid picking up the camera and you're seeing all these legends of the game doing outrageous things. You know, I can picture finishing my school exams and picking up one of Phil Gallagher's Le Boogie mags and looking at Luke Shadbolt's fisheye photography of Luna Park.
Mm.
And I think you may have actually called me about that swell. I don't know, you surfed that swell, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I remember copping a real solid flogging and again, not probably down to scoop lefts as well, being from the land of rights at Cronulla. It was a good
play.
Learning curve out there, but yeah, that session I remember. I think Jared Houston and Jeff Hubbard and Jacob Mera came over for it. I know Kingy and Jonesy went down and towed it. It was like 3 or 4 days in a row, but
yeah,
to your point about Chad Bowl, and I think Sam Venn also took a lot of inspiration from him. He was just in the fucking zone in like 10 to 12 foot meaty as fuck, southwest southern ocean swells. He was just in the devil's lair, so to speak.
Yeah, like respect.
Full respect.
Nothing but.
Yeah.
And I think to a young kid where, you know, you're not thinking about the demise of magazines, you're not thinking about the changing media landscape, you're just seeing this, you're seeing all these guys just pushing it so hard. And I think that was also, you know, I didn't see that in surfing.
Yeah.
You know, what these big guys were doing was just so out there. And I just thought I want to try and be a part of this in whatever way I can.
That's such a valid point you raised, because I know Stabman did an article maybe 6 months ago, and it's been raised on the Swelling podcast a lot about all the greatest creative influences at the moment, whether it be in still photography, videography, art, whatever, have come from the bodyboarding world and infected the rest of the water world essentially. Because You look at like the Cateses, the Ray Collins, the Dav Foxes, you know, like you could just like Phil Gallagher, you could just go on and on and on. Even Luke Shadbolt, like you just look at them and realize that they cut their teeth in the most hectic sort of situations when it comes to operating a camera or a video camera, and then they just move their way into surfing and kind of lead the way, so to speak, and almost pull that next generation of surfers up through their knowledge and ability on those sorts of challenging trips.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a bunch of guys doing stuff as gnarly as it gets, and they're doing it with the least support. Yeah. And the least resources. So they're just doing it because they want to do it, because they're curious, because they love it, or whatever, just cause.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't really get any gnarlier.
It's core as fuck. Yeah.
Like, you can't be. There are two ways about it.
I know.
So, like, I feel fortunate that I grew up in the time when that was, like, in full swing. You know, as a kid, you're just seeing all these guys pushing it, and, like, what a crazy thing to try and be a part of.
So you took that under your wing and you understood, okay, well, this is what I want to be a part of. And you were watching the Shadbolts and the Gallaghers and everyone before us, just, you know, making that pathway possible. And when was it when you first felt like, you know, you were getting the constant calls and editors wanted to get you on trips and you know, and like, mind you, like your career was really peaking and still is, after bodyboarding had that slight slump, so there probably wasn't as much kind of play room, so to speak, in those projects. But, you know, I remember you were always getting calls about like riptide trips, movement trips, like, you know, making shit happen. When was the first trip you went on where you were like, fuck, there's actually budget here?
I mean, I guess I was just cracking it more and more, like, as the magazines went into decline. Yeah. Financially.
Yeah.
So I feel like for whatever progress I was making, things were kind of changing. And you know, there was crossovers and days where we'd go to the South Coast and shoot a bunch of spreads and ads, and that was really nice. But it always felt like I could see that it was just changing so fast. And
yeah,
it felt like before I had a chance to feel like I really got to where I wanted to go with it, the game had changed a little bit. And I think that was, I don't know, it felt like I was always chasing for like a moving target.
Yeah.
A little bit. So. You know, it's interesting that so many guys had years where like it was a solid thing.
Oh, bro, think about Tim Jones.
Yeah, it's insane.
I swear to God, Tim Jones made a proper living there for years, decades, yeah, on properly shooting bodyboarding. Like, and I think to myself, I hope it can get back there.
Yeah.
Because you want to employ people and be able to have them live a prosperous life to then, you know, create more amazing content that actually gets the sport somewhere.
Yeah, and for sure. And I think surfing probably got to do that for 10 years in advance of bodyboarding.
Definitely.
But I guess it put all these people in the boog world in a situation where they're like, all right, well, you know, the writing is on the wall here. Like, what are we going to do? And, you know, you can see guys like Dav went deep into Dav and Catesy.
Yeah.
Doing some of the best work in the surf scene now.
Yeah.
You know, it's just pushed everyone to branch out into whatever called them, and you know, you can kind of see that the skill set and experience from the boot days has taken people far.
So far.
It's fair to say.
100%. And like on these trips, Wally, like you're one to really delve deep into exquisite baked treats.
Absolutely.
Like, where do you find on the East Coast or in Australia in general, for the listeners out there, you'd be going and hitting, you know, what sort of establishment would you be beelining for a great tasty treat?
I mean, it's fortunate that with the abundance of amazing waves in Australia in far-flung corners, equally so, there is an abundance of amazing bakeries.
Oh, agreed.
You know, Bally Point, Ulladulla. I mean, almost every coastal town has a classic waiting to be explored.
And do you feel like you go for one baked treat over another, or is there... Or are you just happy to chance your arm at any sort of baked treat?
You know, once upon a time, I would have said a custard tart.
Oh, you should talk to Custard Tarts Australia.
Yeah. Actually, a friend actually just sent me that like a day ago, going, I thought you might appreciate this, mate.
Dude, do you know who's running that page?
I don't.
None other, and I hope he's not off me to saying this, but I don't think it'll have any clashes. Yeah. None other than the great Stanwell Park larrikin, Dane Woods.
Oh, is he a like-minded brother?
He's a like-minded brother when it comes to that fierce custard in the tart. He's a lover.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to Yeah, we're going to have to talk about this.
I think you have to do a review. Yeah. He's actually wants me to do one too. I did one the other day and unfortunately fucked it up because I went to a kid's park when I was reviewing it. You can hear all the shit in the background, but I'm super keen to go to a local bakery and just put them on the map.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you can hit the sweet spot between like crispness, you know, of the pastry,
yeah,
you know, nothing worse when it falls apart early in the piece.
Oh, and there's been a couple of reviews on there. You can see some like a loving how the skirt falls off. Yeah. You know, and you get like a bit of the undercarriage show, but not too much. A little bit, you
just
know,
just the right balance.
Yeah, you know, a bit, little bit left to leave the mind to a couple of things to be desired, and then you've got some into the good coating of nutmeg and cinnamon. I believe it's a bit dubious at the moment how if it's cinnamon or nutmeg, but I believe it's nutmeg.
Yeah,
I know Woodsy's going with cinnamon just to piss people off at the moment. But and then also the wobble in the and the the free-moving nature, so to speak, of the custard and how it's held together.
Yeah, that little jiggle.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's really a fine game of balances and all these conflicting factors, isn't it?
You can almost compare a really good custard tart to a beautiful female body.
I mean, it's fair to say.
You know what I mean? When you've got great structural integrity, but still a little bit of wobble and jiggle to know that, you know, there's a little bit of sweetness in that tray.
A bit of sweetness to be had.
Oh, mate, we all love a tart every now and again. But okay, so sweet. Let's get back on track. So you've climbed the ranks of Boogan. You were doing heaps of shoots. I remember you chasing it super hard. And then when was the time that you transitioned more into the kind of surf world?
I think I was pushing pretty hard with photography, but I guess I felt like I was pushing in a direct. Yeah, I felt like things were moving in a different direction in the media world. So I'd always been into film, into video. And I think that felt like, okay, now's the time to give this a shot a bit more.
So when you transitioned from bodyboarding with stills, you kind of said, fuck, I'm going to go to video too.
Yeah. I guess I don't feel like I went away from bodyboarding consciously. It's just I picked up a video camera and things kind of developed from that.
For sure. I was more so saying you were chasing more of a accessible career in something that was going to reward you for your efforts instead of just banging your head up against the wall the whole time.
I mean, it's always nice to get something back instead of just some head bashing.
And also to move forward with your career. Like, it's all well and good to still do it for the love of the game. And we, you know, we all do that from time to time, but sometimes the bills have got to be paid.
Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah. So I think film was a pretty obvious kind of approach there. Like, I could see there was an opportunity to do. I mean, it wasn't far from what I was already doing. I was just taking a motion approach to the same places and the ocean and the same moments, I guess, I was already chasing, and I just wanted to see what was possible in motion. I didn't really have a set plan on, okay, like, here's the grand vision for this. But I think over those few years, you know, it takes years just to figure out the skill set and figure out what the possibilities are. And I guess the journey kind of just took hold, and within a year or two of kind of picking up motion, I met up with Laura Enover and Matt Dunbar, and we ended up making that film.
Yeah.
And I think that was probably a pretty big one.
Undone.
That was a pretty big process.
Yeah. Well, that was a world internationally recognized film.
And I guess it was very cowboy, you know, we were just like, we believe in this, so let's just go and do it.
Yeah.
And I think in the same way that you go and do that in Booging, you want to believe that's the right way to do things.
Well, let's put it this way. If that challenge, if that adventure, if that movie wasn't a success, would Laura Enover be where she is right now?
Well, I mean, I hope it helped her on her journey.
It definitely did, man. Like, I know you're being real humble there, but like, for me, that was the huge kickoff point for Laura Enover to just go, I'm here. I'm leading the way I know Justine DuPont was also doing some great things, and there's still heaps of great female charges out there in the world of surfing, and also in like the world of bodyboarding with Lily Pollard and Alexandra Rinder and heaps of people. But even Sophie Jane too, down on the South Coast. Shout out to Sophie Jane. I want my bodyboard king hat back. Thank you. It's just to borrow. I do need that back later on. You know what I mean? Like, that movie catapulted her into the big wave Dave scene, so to speak.
And I mean, it's very cool, I think, that obviously she had the talent and had the fire and had the skill. And
but you had to push it into those things, man. Like, I remember you telling me about setting up, like, breathwork training and setting up mentors and making sure she was connecting with the right people through connections that you had. Like, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes that probably isn't documented in that movie that I was privy to at times that really made me understand the whole process.
Yeah, I guess it takes a village with that stuff a little bit, doesn't it?
It does.
You know, and I guess thinking back to the bodyboard scene, you know, you have all your like-minded mates that are all going to the same places at the same time and everyone's calling everyone going, like, are you going to be there? Imagine wanting to go and do that but not having any of the network around it.
Mm.
And I think, you know, for Laura, like, it's new ground for women's surfing, you know? It's not like there's a crew of like-minded people that are getting on the phone to her, telling her when there's a shippy swell. So I guess that was the opportunity, you know? So I'm glad we could kind of facilitate and support and tell that story. And I think it was very rewarding to see what people got out of that.
Oh, people got so much out of that.
And beyond surfing as well.
Yeah.
It was a really big lesson for me, actually, because I was very, like, caught up in the core surf world. And even when we made that film, I had this image in my head that we had to go and surf this wave at this size and get this kind of wave and get this kind of shot, and that would be the metric of success. And so I was really caught up on that, like, probably for the first half of making the film. And then somewhere along the way, and, you know, I think it may have come from Laura and it may have come from the people around us making the film, and we kind of just realized that the process of her just figuring out this stuff, you know, going to the right and figuring out what you have to do to surf that wave is actually more authentic, and it's not about trying to just leapfrog to the master point, you know, where someone that spent their whole life surfing these waves gets to, and trying to fake that. You know, it's about being real and, like, okay, we are going here for the first time. I'm shit scared. I don't know if I'm even going to surf.
Mm-hmm.
And just show that process.
Enjoy the process, yeah, because that's where all the challenges arise, and that's where there's some victories and also some losses.
Yeah, and it's authentic.
Yeah, and people look at that and be like, wow, she was scared like I was.
Yeah.
And she had no idea like I do. Oh, yeah. I don't, you know what I mean? Like, so it's like, when you see those characteristics shown from a professional athlete who was, you know, did really well in the QS and the World Tour and, you know, was the kind of pin-up girl there in Australia for a while for professional CT surfing, to see her then go through that process and learn again, I think is really humbling. And I think it's really important for a lot of people to see, because the hard work behind the scenes there was psycho.
Yeah, I mean, it was a big one.
Mm.
And I think everyone involved in that, we all just thought, okay, this is worth doing. You know, we don't know where this will all land. And ultimately, when we picture locked the film on, like, March the 1st, and we had the world premiere on March the 8th, and I think on March the 11th, New South Wales was in a state of total lockdown, and there were no events, and everything was done. But on the 8th, we got a sold-out premiere show with, like, 1,300 people, which was nuts.
Where was that at?
At the Hayden Orpheum in Cremorne.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So
yeah.
Two cinemas full of people, and it was, like, all of our friends and everyone, people just screaming.
So
people good. Carrying on and screaming and having an epic time. And after a pretty tough process making that, that was such a reward.
Yeah.
I was so grateful to have that. And we had like a 50 plus stop tour planned all around Australia that would have been insane as well, and then that kind of got postponed a year, but, you know, we got our hometown premiere, so
yeah, that's amazing. And that's a great theater to do it in.
That was a big one. But I think looking back at Undone, I'm really proud of the fact that we provided like an empowering, uplifting story that not just young female surfers, but anyone can look at just an authentic story of someone pushing themselves to do something they believe in.
For sure. And it wasn't overdone.
And I think the opportunity, like, I really believe that people deserve the opportunity to throw themselves into these things, and there is a space in these sports for people. And I guess in, you know, it was, Laura was pushing to new ground in women's surfing, really.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, no one had really been there like that, chased that hard over all those different slabs.
Yeah.
People put time in a lot of different waves, but pretty rare to see someone go, you know, on a bodyboarding-esque schedule of no sleep, tuna cans, and just like highway driving for days on end, man.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, Laura. I shouldn't have inflicted that on you. It was cruel.
No, you did, because you made it what she is today. That's the challenges that you need to overcome, and that's how much it just showed. You know, you can marry back to bodyboarding how you get out what you put in. It's like the old Nutri-Grain ad. Do you know what I mean?
Well, you want to believe it, don't you?
For sure.
With all things in the world.
Yeah, and that's what I'm getting at. It teaches the life lesson of, like, you want this, work hard. But, like, there's so many... I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but there are so many entitled little cunts in this world right now, Wally, that literally don't understand what bodyboarders and surfers and everyone was doing 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
It's not seen as much these days because, you know, social media can put this clip out and do this and get away with things quite easily and almost masquerade around looking like you're putting the time in, where you go back to the days of video and Rome and all these epic, you know, like, sections on bodyboarding, and they do not understand, the general human today does not understand the logistics, the efforts, even the road itself, like with Brendo and Matic taking that boat out to the archipelago of southwestern WA islands there and coming so close to death, but somehow being guided through, supposedly by God, by other forces. I don't doubt it at times because I don't know how they didn't fucking die. But
yeah,
that's just one example of the shit that needs to be put on the line to get those gratifying moments, not just on like a world scale, but like internally for yourself to know that you've overcome these challenges. And it's not in the generation today. There's certain people out there that are still kind of humming those tunes, but we need more fucking grit, cunt. We need more like determination, and we need more, like, you know, for example, there's people from the Island Challenge, right?
Mm.
That all put their names up in lights and put their hands up and, oh, pick me and I should be in and all that kind of stuff. Young crew too. That, like, I'm listening to them and going, mate, at your age, I had driven across Australia 3 times searching for waves. I'd gone to Hawaii and done 2 seasons. I'd gone out to different islands in the Pacific to try and search waves. I'd gone to America and you know, scoured that coastline. And there's so many places I could have still gone, but, like, you're trying to sell to me that you can do a backflip and a spin in the pit here at these waves at home, yet you're not willing to put your ass on the line and dedicate your life to a sport that you want to get something out of, and then you want to be put up in lights on one of the world's biggest stages just because you think you deserve it at home at the age of 22. Fuck off.
Yeah, it's the spirit of booging, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, to go on... I mean, when you grow up looking... When Brendan Newton and Luke Shadbolt, and you're seeing these guys do that... The bar has been set, you know.
For sure.
And it's not a low bar.
Like Brendo going, it's not at all. Brendo going over to Gran Canaria and those yellow bird clips, remember? Of, you know, the front page of Rippy's there and, like, him in a monstrosity of gurgles, like of the Atlantic Ocean just heaving up, man, and almost encompassing him in in water that you could not possibly make it out of. And he got flogged in so many ways, but made so many epic ones. But he went over there just on the back of, you know, just hopes and dreams and possibilities, and made it happen.
Yeah.
And now it's a known wavefront, Tom, but, like, that back then was like a big frontier to get over, and people this day and age don't really see, like, a small percentage do, but a large percentage just want that instant gratification on Instagram and then not put the hard work in.
Yeah.
That's what I'm getting at. It fucking shits me to tears.
Yeah, it's a bit unfortunate, isn't it?
Yeah. And when you look at your life, you're the exact opposite. You've gone to the nth degree in so many crazy situations. Like, you know, you even doing your scuba course, you doing your underwater breathwork course, you go into the mountains doing backcountry skiing and taking me up to, like, Mount Kosciuszko and us camping up there and, like, on the main range there in the New South Wales Alps, and me almost freezing to death. And all this sort of shit is so far gone with certain people. And it's not for everyone. I'm not saying it's for everyone, but it kind of loses its value and currency in this day and age, because people don't really understand what you've done or what you've achieved, because you're so flooded with content that like is either made up or it's you know, plastered upon a screen to make look like you've done X, Y, and Z, but it's just all been cut really well, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess things are so curated, and then at the same time we're just bombarded with media like increasingly like never before, and like way beyond our bandwidth to even fathom. But I guess for me, it's, I don't know if there was a moment, but it's just, it becomes clearer and clearer all the time that going out into nature and into like frontier environments and, you know, not even pushing yourself, but just being in those places, it's just such a powerful experience. And I think you can always, it's just so real and so authentically satisfying. And I think in the same way that you get that feeling from a crazy surf or whatever, you can go walk like deep into the mountains and do whatever. And it's kind of the same approach. And wherever you get it, I think it's just an amazingly fulfilling way to spend your time. So for me, I think I just gravitate towards that, you know, whatever the environment is, it's just where I want to be.
Well, you've been into many frontiers, and we need to recap what's been the most challenging frontier and almost the near-death experience besides me rolling a car at 120k. what's been like the proper moment in the ocean on a bodyboard or behind a camera or whatever on a jet ski have you experienced where you thought this could possibly be the end or this is the end?
Oh, you know, I think I've been really lucky over the years. You know, I can't say I've had a moment where I'm like, this is it. And I worry sometimes that I've gotten away with it so much that I'll get complacent and I'll put myself in a position that is just so far beyond.
So there's never been a moment like where you've got washed in or you've caught things on the head or you've had a ski malfunction or you've had anything where you could possibly have just, the outcome could be death?
I mean, I've gotten destroyed like everyone. Don't get me wrong.
What's been the worst destroying? Like, what's been the moment where you've just gone, that was a flogging?
Oh, I think, honestly, one day at Pife.
In Hawaii? Yeah, really?
Yeah, I got really done in and, like, got washed up the beach on, like, a big second reef morning. And, you know, when you spend some time in Hawaii, I think you get pretty water confident.
Yeah.
And you just start swimming out in 6 to 8 foot waves, like, whatever. And you've got the fitness and you've got the familiarity and you're kind of in that zone. And you just start toying with it a little bit. And I remember I got this mega beating where I got like washed up. I basically came up like in the short break at Pipe and like stood up on the sand and just took myself in and called it a day. And I don't think anyone even really saw it or knew, but I got so put in my place. And then I went home from that trip and I came back to Sydney. And on the south coast, there was a big east swell like a day or two after I arrived. And I went to shoot fisheye. I was actually with Jace Finlay at a little wave down in Wollongong. And it was 4 foot, crystal clear blue, like westerly. It was just one of those epic days. And so I was shooting fisheye and it was just like child's play. It was so fun.
Was this a beachy?
This is a wave in near Port Kembla.
Yeah.
Little reefy, little peaky, slabby reef. Good one for the fisheye.
Yeah.
And so I was super fit, fresh off the plane from Hawaii, just like, oh, whatever, you know, no worries. And I got caught inside, ducked under a wave, and this 4 footer in shallow water, in like knee thigh deep water, just picked me up, back slammed me on the reef. And then I was like, oh, that was pretty hectic. My back was tingling and it was like a proper big impact. And there was a second wave, and then the second wave did the exact same thing to me. And I don't think I've ever had as harsh a slam straight away. And I came in and I remember Jace pulled a bit of rock out of my back, like
whoa,
chunk of rock, like with tweezers in my lower back. And I've still got like two bumps, like just above my glutes from that now.
Really?
But both those beatdowns happened in like 5 days.
Isn't it funny? You've gone from two different environments there, Wally. You've gone from the the Colosseum of big wave surfing, so to speak, at Pipe. Like, you know, that is, everyone knows floggings occur on a regular basis and people die there every year surfing that wave or shooting that wave. And then you come back to the East Coast where a lot of people talk about the lack of period in the swell, so there's not as much energy and all the sort of stuff. But I guess underselling some of the sharpness and shallowness of our reefs, you know, even a 4 foot wave. Like, people at the island here, man, like, the smaller days are the worst because, you know, you don't have as much water between you and that reef. And yeah, the drowning factor's not there as much, but the impact factor's really there.
Yeah, I remember last time I surfed the island, you might have even called me into a wave and I got sucked over the falls and smoked my leg and was out.
I remember that.
Struggling for a year.
Yeah, man, yeah.
On that.
That was like the side of your quad.
Yeah.
I do remember that.
Yeah, but we just spent that whole first COVID year just struggling, like flaring knee injury, but...
Fuck.
You know, all good, but just doesn't take much out there.
Doesn't, man. And dude, talking about severe injuries, you just reminded me, you broke your fucking leg real bad.
Oh, yeah, I did snap my leg.
Let's go over that story, because I've actually just glazed over that. And that's a week down the mountains with Adrian Emerson you're probably never going to forget.
Yeah, I mean, that was a great week in Thredbo.
Yeah.
One of those weeks when the Australian winter just turns on the tap.
Yeah.
Non-stop snowfalls day after day. Good.
You got Reggae Ellis all over the fucking radio waves just speaking about best week in the Aussie Alps this year. Get down here, cunt.
It was gala. Like, it was all time. And you know, I think we were there for 7 or 8 days at that point and just ski-touring out of Thredbo and riding the resort and... There was a bunch of good crew down there getting amongst it. It was just a good time. And then there was one morning where I went up super early, like first thing on the chairlift. It was midweek. There wasn't many people around, but it snowed a bit.
And you'd also been hitting the nightlife pretty hard at night, I've heard too, and doing the old sleep in the car and get back up the next day.
We were sleeping like sleeping in the car in the car park, you know.
Pretty cold.
Like roughing it for sure.
Yeah.
And yeah, like we, you know, we had friends in town, there was parties on, there was all sorts of stuff happening.
Yeah.
So it was just a big, like a big occasion.
Big alpine blowout. Yeah.
And so we went up, I went up solo. I don't know what everyone else was. I think people were kind of coming and going that day.
Mm-hmm.
But I was standing under the snow gums chair, like on my own at about 9 o'clock, and it was great. And you know, when you've been riding for a bunch of days in a row, I guess you're in the zone, you're feeling confident,
mm-hmm.
just like Pife,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're battle fit, you're in the zone.
And was this coming down bush ranges?
Yeah. Under the chair.
And bush ranges, for anyone out there listening, if they haven't skied Thredbo or haven't skied that run, bush ranges is known as an extremely enjoyable intermediate to an advanced run, depending on the lines you take, because of the gladed trees, the known pops and drops off the boulders, but also can get tracked out at times after a certain time of the day and be, you know, a little bit hit and miss. And if you do have fresh snow on the top of it after maybe say a thaw or a freeze, it can also be deceiving at times that you have a beautiful cover of snow, but there's rock hard concrete underneath.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was coming down there going pretty fast, and I actually came around one corner and there was one of the mountain ops guys that was fencing like a little feature off the side of the run, and I didn't really expect to see anyone there, and I was probably going too fast, to be honest, so I cut left and kind of went away from this guy, and I went left over a rollover that I thought was smaller, it was actually kind of big, so I went... I went kind of flying, and as I came off this boulder rollover, one ski kind of caught on a little bush or something.
Oh.
So I was launched like off balance, and I landed off balance and I just tumbled end over end, and I was in backcountry bindings at the time. So when you fall, you don't have the pop out release like you normally would on skis.
Yeah.
And if you fall forwards and twisting, it just doesn't, they don't release.
No. They're meant not to release.
And it's just the technology. But I tumbled, did like 2 or 3 somersaults, like end over end. And then on one of those, the skis then caught in the snow, but I still had the momentum and I kept going. And above the top of my ski boot, my leg just went... And,
Can you explain to the listeners what that feeling was like and the sound?
Well, I heard the sound a little bit. But I was sitting there in the snow and my leg was suspended on like a little shrub. And I was like in the soft snow and I was like, oh, am I hurt? Yeah, I think I'm hurt. But, you know, the adrenaline is pumping, yeah. So you don't really know. And I've gone, maybe I'm okay. So I've stood up and then gone, yeah, okay, I think I've done something. And I've looked down at my leg and my like lower half of my leg's off at an angle that's not straight. It's like, okay, it's not supposed to be that way. So I sat back down and jumped on the phone and I was going to call for help. And the Telstra network on that day in Thredbo was out of service.
Fuck.
So phone shut down. But I was just under the chairlift, but there was no one coming up. Like, it was super early in the morning still. And I think they'd even let me on before they actually opened the resort. So eventually one guy skied down, like past where I was, and he came over and he goes, hey man, you know, you good? And he stopped and he lifted up his goggles and I saw his face just go white when he looked at my leg. I was like, oh no.
That's when you know shit's fucked.
That's when you know it's not great. So I was like, look, can you go and call ski patrol? And yeah, I might need some help here.
Fuck, brother.
And so he took off and then like 20 minutes later, the ski patrol guys came down and had a look at it and they're like, yep, that's a broken leg.
Wow. And so it wasn't a compound fracture, was it?
No, it was borderline compound, but not still in the skin. Which is
Thank God. But a full clean break.
A clean snap, yeah, like super clean. So,
and can you please just tell the viewers what you did next? Because this still blows me away, but your pain management skills are wild, brother.
Well, I guess the adrenaline was on at that point. You know, they sledded me down the mountain.
Were you on heroin? Were you on crack cocaine? Like, how did you keep going?
I did cop the green whistle halfway down, because why not?
Fucking why not?
You know, the pain was starting to set in a little bit.
But yeah.
The guy, my ski foot boot was actually still in the ski binding. So we had to get transported down the mountain, we had to release the binding.
What kind of binding do you have?
Market kingpins.
Oh, that's what I've got at the moment.
Pin bindings. Yeah, so yeah, yeah. Great bindings until you tomahawk diagonally front legs. For sure. Don't do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And
so you were taking them off from the front?
Take off at the back.
Take off the back, okay. Yeah,
yeah, like no pin binding relief. If you fall front ways and they're like the Pintec bindings, they just don't pop out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just a thing with them.
Oh, I've used them still in the resort to this day because I've only got one pair of skis and like on icy conditions, I'm definitely very wary of knowing that I could just catch an edge and I'm not going to release.
Yeah. And I think I was just like, whatever, you know, it'll be sweet.
Yeah. But and if you're touring unlucky, in and out of the resort, I understand why I've got them on.
Yeah. It was just one of those things.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know.
Lucky it wasn't in the main range.
Yeah. Well, it would have been serious if it was, you know, out west or somewhere.
You could have died out there, really.
It would have been, mate, would have been a big deal.
You probably would have to get a chopper.
Yeah, if you could.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to break a leg up in that country.
Well, mate, you see what happens to the Brumbies out there when they break their legs.
Yeah, it's not great. It's not a good outcome.
They're just mowed down by the National Park guys.
Yeah, it's all over Red Rover.
Machine guns.
Yeah, it's brutal.
Yeah, it's brutal. So, yeah, and then you got down the bottom, and then what were the options? Medical treatment?
It was Thredbo Medical Center, you know, it was a splint and all of that stuff. It's all good. And then it was, okay, so we can either transport you in an ambulance to Canberra Hospital and then you do an operation there and we'll rejoin it and whatever, put in metal hardware and then you stay there for some days. Or if you can somehow get to Sydney, then you can go there, we'll do it the next day and then you can go home and, you know, whatever. So I had all these friends in the valley at that point who were coming and going, and so I called our good friend Adrian Shark Emerson.
Yeah, the big shark.
The big shark himself.
Shout out to the great white shark.
And he'd actually just left. He was half an hour down the valley road, and I explained what had happened, and I said, look, could you give me a lift back to Sydney? You know, I'm going to be jacked up on the green whistle.
Yeah, so yeah, like, yeah.
If I can just shimmy into your back seat, you know, park up, and then we just beeline it straight to Royal North Shore.
And did he say at any stage, if you can get me a second green whistle, I'll do it?
He didn't need any persuading. He turned around and came straight back.
What a good bloke.
Good man.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we jumped in and I don't know if my chat was that great on the way back to Sydney.
Oh, I'm sure you always got great car chat. He would have been just... He would have been lapping it up, I reckon, because you would have been telling all sorts of secrets.
I mean, I was pretty dosed up. I didn't even know what was talked about on that on that car ride.
You guys got a strong relationship now, so I'm sure it was quality shit.
Yeah, so he basically pulled me out of his car at like 7 p.m. that night at Royal North Shore. I was wheeled in a wheelchair into Royal North Shore, spent the night, was operated on, and then left the next day. It was all good.
It's amazing that you went 6 hours without really any pain medication. I mean, the green mist was one thing for sure, but how long does that last for, man?
Yeah, I mean, it was getting rough by the end, for
fucking
sure.
Fucking the last hour would have been crazy.
It was getting rough. But
the bumps?
I don't know. I think they did a pretty good job splinting it or something.
Okay.
It was like, if I could stay still, it was fine.
Wow.
But it was like, the moment I had any movement, it was like very painful. It was, you know, C-style kind of pain, like not very nice.
And so what was the recovery like? Because I know I remember speaking to you a couple of times during your physiotherapy and getting things sorted. And like, you know, the structural integrity of your leg is paramount to you being an operating human in this world. Like,
for sure.
How did you go with it all?
I mean, it was... Yeah, I couldn't run for like 2 years without getting pain. And like, I had metal rods and hardware like put through the whole tib fib area.
Are they still in there?
Still in there.
Wow.
So eventually it just stopped giving me any grief, so I didn't take them out.
Cool.
I just let it be, but I think I was 4 or 5 months out of the surf and kind of slowly back into it.
That would have been so hard.
It was tough.
Yeah.
But it's all
what did
good.
You do in that time, that downtime?
Well, you know, I think the other thing is as well, a clean break of the leg is so much better than you do an ACL or an MCL.
Yeah.
And that's like, that's a year out.
For sure.
You know, that's no good.
And that's also with the lack of kind of warranty and insurances that it won't happen again. Like, it's very rare you're going to break your leg again. So some say even when you calcify that bone over, it becomes stronger once again, like stronger than it originally was. With an ACL or a shoulder joint or anything like that, like, man, they're just popping out left, right, and center.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, you hear the stories of people that go and do it again. It's just, it's terrible.
Oh, it's fucked.
Like, the motivation it would take to come back from that.
I know. It'd
be rough.
It would be.
You know, I'm all good now and I'm grateful. I can do whatever I have to do. And, you know, I don't really know about it other than when I go through airport scanners.
I was just about to ask you, like, what's the go there? Does it beep every time?
Only sometimes. Some airports,
really?
They're like, are you carrying metal on you?
Yeah.
And then, you know, that's the only time. Yeah. I wouldn't know I've got it in there otherwise. So.
Does it ever beep and go off and then they're heaps suspicious of you and they're like, okay, so we need to do an anal cavity search?
I mean, I got touched right up in London the other day.
Did ya?
Like, yeah. Like, not taken into the back room, but like...
As in frisked?
Pad.
Really?
You know, hands in all sorts of places.
Did at any stage, did they grab your scrotum?
Brushed.
Really?
Yeah, not grabbed, but brushed.
Funny you say that, because me and Loz have been chowing down at night with the second kid and watching a lot of the border security replays, like the old episodes. Fuck, man. There are some people out there that do some wild shit.
Yeah.
Like, one dude came in with, I think, 80 single bags of cocaine shoved up his anus.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And, like, one of them breaks, bro. Two of them breaks, three of them breaks, you are on a wild ride.
Yeah.
To death, essentially.
Yeah, pack it up.
And like, yeah, pack her up, boys. Like, when I think of it, you know, I mean, I don't mind dabbling in drugs every now and again, recreational ones, of course, but like, to think about traveling around the world with narcotics through the airport, it's one of the most psycho situations I reckon you can put yourself in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Hardcore, isn't it?
My brother accidentally... on his wild European trip back when he was like 22 or 23 or something, and went over there with the boys. He went over when he was quite young, at like 18, 19 for soccer. He was really good at European football.
Yeah.
He tried for a couple of clubs. And then he went back over on a boys trip and just sent it like the shy rat that he is. And I'm pretty sure there's a couple of times he rocked up in airports and had just gone through flights, not knowing that he had little bags of MD or coke in pockets and all this sort of stuff. You know, it's like Europe's just filled with that stuff, and it's easy to get mistaken. But man, one wrong move, eh?
Heavy. Like,
Michelle Corby vibes. Chappelle Corby vibes, sorry.
Yeah. Might take a pisser.
Yeah, right, yeah, let's pause it.
Oh, busting the pisser for like 5 minutes, eh?
We'll be back in a second.
Oh. been out in nature too long, you know, when you just like piss wherever.
Oh, fucking hell, I love it. Bathroom. Just to your left. Okay. Literally just right there.
Been out in the wild way too much. You know when you're out camping and that, and you just take a leak wherever and then come back into civilization.
It's so nice. It's I think it's one of the best things about being out in the wild.
Yeah.
We should take a photo.
Yeah, 100.
Psycho. I sent it to the boys.
I love it.
I love it. Wait, Arkham, I'll take a quick piss too.
Yeah, good op.
Yeah, good op. The only piss in your own mouth in this room. Yeah, no bubblers.
None of that. Leave that there.
Alright, we're back after that piss break and that ridiculously wild off-topic story about my brother carrying packets through European airports. Great to be back with you, Wally. How's the leak?
Yeah, very good. Much needed.
Oh, mate, so good to drain the main vein. But let's go back to your story of, you know, transferring your skill set from bodyboarding and the things that you've learned through the challenges that bodyboarding presented you into your creative works, and also through to your like different plights and challenges that you're facing now. Like, you know, not many people would know that you have moved over to Iceland now. And that's been a huge relocation for you after all your different adventures throughout the world. And you're currently over there, like, relocated as a... Are you as an Icelandic citizen yet? Or are you gonna...
I'm not a resident, not a citizen.
Okay, so...
Not yet.
Yeah. Are you looking to do that?
Maybe one day.
Wow, hectic.
We'll see how we go.
How long can you stay over there without becoming a citizen?
I mean, I've got a visa to be there, you know, multi-year kind of visa, so that's fine. But it's been really interesting just learning what that place is all about, because I think so many people have a relationship with it as a tourist, and that's one thing. You know, it's like how tourists come to Australia and they go up to the Great Barrier Reef and they go to the Apostles and they go to Uluru and all these different spots that, like, a lot of Australians don't necessarily even go to. And I think Iceland is kind of that. Like, if you go there as a traveller, you might drive a few thousand kilometres going to all these spots and having this crazy time. But then to settle and live over there and be part of that culture, it's actually been quite different. And I was kind of drawn to moving there on... I had this idea of what it would be. And then the reality has turned out to be... I've been living in Reykjavik, in the big city, I suppose.
Yep. And what's the population of the big city, just so people get a...
Well, the country is 400,000. I think 280,000 of them are in Reykjavik.
Fuck, bro. Fuck. Like, I know it's a small little landmass, so to speak, you know, in comparison to the States or America, or, I mean, in Australia, whatever, but to think that there's only 400,000 people there and we're a relatively small country with 25 million, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's not a lot. And,
wow.
And it is exciting because things can change fast there. You know, it's agile and there's so many unexplored things in that country.
How easy would it be doing an election there?
Yeah.
400,000 votes, but well, then even with the kids, like, you're not counting them. Like, wow, that's psycho.
And I do appreciate that about the familiarity and it's got, it's the small town feels, but scaled up big, you know, in Iceland, like the 6 degrees of separation or whatever, you know, almost every person you meet, it's quite likely they're friends with one of your friends or your family, or there's a lot of like connectivity there. And it means that I think when you find a good group of people, you know, you quickly get to know, you know, you find the like-minded people quickly. And it's just such a surreal experience living there.
That's sick. And so at what stage, you know, I know you went over there to explore and to, on like a trip of leisure, you were going over there with, the host of the podcast, The Diary of the Wild Ones. What was his name again?
Yeah, I got to spend some time with Aaron. And
Aaron, yep.
Thank you to Aaron for pestering me to come and spend some weeks with you in the van in Iceland.
Yeah, that's a cool podcast, hey.
That's an amazing podcast.
Yeah, he's interviewed some really cool people. Shout out to Aaron. I didn't mean to be rude to forget your name, so I've only heard your voice numerous times on a podcast. But yeah, that's so cool. So it just kind of grew from there organically, and then you found yourself obsessed with the place.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was there in March, so like kind of the end of winter.
And what year is this?
This was last year.
2023.
So yeah. Not really that long ago.
Yeah.
A lot's happened since then.
Oh, that is a long time when you think about it, though. Like, essentially in our lifetime, if we'd lived to 80, it's not so much time. But at the same time, like a lot passes during that.
For sure.
That time period.
And I think March in Iceland is this... It's midwinter, you know, it's minus 20, it's brutal, but the days are getting longer, you know, it's more daylight than we have now in Sydney winter, for example. So yeah. You can go and do whatever you want to do in the day, really.
And were you touring a lot then?
Yeah, we're doing a lot of skiing.
Yeah.
Skiing and mountain climbing, and there's just infinite possibilities. Like Aaron and I went, we were kind of on a bit of a surf snow trip, and we weren't really glued to like, okay, we have to do this and that. And in Iceland, you learn that pretty fast as well. You try and talk forecasts. You know, we look at swell forecasts a week out and are already thinking of where we're going to go and surf or what we're going to do or what the experience will be. Over there, you talk like that to an Icelander and they just kind of look at you funny. Like, what are you doing? Like, no, we'll just look at it the night before. And we'll just be there on the day and see what the day is like. Because wow. It can be so unpredictable there that it kind of forces this go with the flow mentality of not being super caught up in expectation of, okay, the weather's going to be good at 3 o'clock, so we're going to go climb this mountain then and then ski here and then ski there. And it's actually really nice.
You just kind of turn up without any expectation, know that the storms can be volatile and they can change at any given stage, and then... If you're lucky into something, it's beautiful. If you don't, you cop your medicine, learn the lesson, and continue on enjoying your day.
Yeah, I mean, you go and park your van at the surf spot or at the mountain, and you make a cup. You have another cup of coffee.
Yeah,
and you hang out. You know,
sick.
And it's very nice.
Yeah.
And I think for me, after many years of maybe forcing outcomes, I don't know if you want to call it that, but what we've been talking about, you know, where you're trying to pick the eyes out of a swell or go and take a photo or get a certain shot or whatever, where it has to be so meticulous. You have to be analyzing all these factors and, you know, building an expectation. Otherwise, you don't succeed.
You almost take the mystique and the beauty out of the actual situation at hand.
Yeah, it just becomes methodical, you know, and I think... That's what I love about Icelandic culture, because the environment is so volatile, you can't be that way. You can't be methodical and you can't have expectations. You just have to be willing to roll with it.
Are they pretty easygoing people, the Icelanders?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think in the outdoor world, I think they're humbled by the nature regularly.
And what's like a huge cultural difference there that you've seen? Like what's something that... You know, I mean, there'd be many, but here in Australia, like, you know, it's just the done thing. But over there, it's just, what are you doing kind of thing?
I mean, small talk.
Yeah, okay.
Small talk's a big one, you know.
So you only speak when you've got something purposeful to say.
Yeah, I mean, you need to speak with substance. If you speak for the sake of speaking, people just don't quite understand. And, you know, I inflict a little bit of my Australia dribble on people.
You're a good dribbler.
Sometimes.
An amazing dribbler. Like, it's a skill set. I mean, I understand it might not fly over there, but on a car trip over 25 hours, you want a dribbler.
Oh, absolutely.
You want someone to be able to yarn with and just, you know, go through amazing possibilities, because a lot of colloquialism and shit talk comes up through it, and it's just, it feeds our culture.
I mean, so, there's ground to cover, isn't there, on those long trips in the car and
there is
the long road of life.
100%. Many baked treats to sample, many coffees to drink, and much shit to talk.
Yeah, big time. So, I mean, when... I think a funny story is my partner Berglind, her dad, I would see him and I'd say, "Yolwe, how are you going?" And he turned around like at some point and asked Berglind, he's like, "I don't understand. So Steve always asks me, how are you going? Like, what does he expect me to say? Does he want me to tell him about my shitty day at work and about how I had to do this and that? Like, what does it mean? And, you know, things like that. It's just little things, but
that's such a nonchalant thing to say here.
Yeah.
It's so like, "Hey, how are you, man? What's happening?" That's how I start almost every conversation.
Yeah. And it makes you reflect. Like, if I say, "Luke, how are you going?" I'm really opening the possibility. You know, you might tell me everything about how it's going. You might tell me about, "Hey, the wheels are falling off your life and you're having the worst time ever," and I'm standing there going, "Oh, okay, I didn't really ask for that, but okay, I opened the door, so I'm gonna cop it."
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's just this open-ended invite, and that's something that I think that's just a funny story, because full credit to Yolwe, he loves to chat and loves to dribble, but it's just different styles of communication.
And so what's the most awkward situation you've had with an Icelandic individual that, like, you've kind of been like, "Fuck, I've really put my foot in it this time"?
Yeah, I think, honestly, every time you meet anyone for the first time, people are so proper and serious, and you just feel like, you know, you can't strike up any momentum in the conversation. And often you meet that person for the second time and it's like a whole different deal. You know, it feels like in Australia, perhaps you get past the, you know, you get surface level connection with people really quick.
Yeah.
All the time, everywhere you go, standing in line, waiting for your custard tart, you know, you have a chat, you get that going.
"Can't wait for this fucking tart, mate. Oh yeah, me too. Love this tart.
Bloody ripper, mate."
Yeah.
But it doesn't progress past a certain point.
Yeah.
You know, there's like a, whether it's conscious or not, but there's like a limit there. It's just small talk, you know, and that's kind of it. And I think there, you don't get to small talk, but once you crack people and once you're in, you know, you quite quickly can make really good connections with people.
And it's an open book kind of thing by then, like the second or third time, they feel like they kind of, they warm to you, so to speak, in the harsh Nordic winter.
I don't know, but I think it's common of a lot of cold places as well, that you need to kind of build a bit of trust, that perhaps people are a little closed off to protect themselves from the
environment. Well, life's pretty fucked up there, eh? Like, I mean, life's beautiful. Obviously, they know what they're doing, the Nordics, and it's, as you were saying off air, it's the original OG Viking area, but, like, it seems to me that they live in pretty harsh conditions.
Yeah, and I mean, look, Iceland is funny because it's actually not even in the Arctic Circle. It's on the edge of the Arctic Circle.
Oh, really?
Common perception that we're like on the top of the planet somewhere away from everywhere, and it's a 15-hour flight down to the UK.
You know,
it's 3 hours flight from anywhere in Europe. So it's just out in the middle of the Atlantic.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure,
green. And that's why they get all the storms.
Yeah. It's like where the storms that you see hit Nazaré and Ireland and all these places, those storms basically just lash the bottom of Iceland all winter. So it's kind of wild because that's where the cold Arctic air meets the southern Atlantic air, and it's volatile.
Yeah, wow.
That's kind of... And Greenland is only 400 kilometers away to the west. So it's in an interesting part of the world.
Yeah, definitely. For sure. It's in its own little zone. And it's a very, same before, very seafood abundant area.
Fair to say.
So that was that. That's the backbone of their economy over there.
Yeah, I mean, fishing is what gave them so much. Like, people have said to me that Iceland was a third world developing country in a lot of ways, like in not that long ago, in the 70s and the 80s. And I guess people now see it as a wealthy Scandinavian progressive country, which it is. But fishing is a big part of that.
Yeah, wow. And you were saying too that some of your friends over there have lost their parents and loved ones to the ocean.
I think culturally it's very real, you know. I think we have this relationship with the ocean, like, and whether you're in surfing or not, I think everyone that lives anywhere near the coast in Australia gets it. You know, they get the value of the coast as a place of connection and recreation and joy and
the seriousness of it too.
And also the seriousness of it.
Yeah.
But I guess they see both sides of it. You know, it's something that demands respect, but it's a place that you can
play
and experience like life-changing, wonderful stuff.
Yeah. But over there, it's completely different.
Yeah, and I mean, over there, the surf community is having a really hard time with this because there is one particular wave, and there are waves all around Iceland. You know, there are countless incredible setups that break once or twice a year. And if you're not really on the ball, or even if you're really on the ball, you know, it's a hard place to get good surf. Mm. That's just the reality of it.
But when you get it, it can be amazing.
It can be world class.
Yeah.
But the thing that you really struggle with there is a consistent go-to wave, you know, because there's not a lot of beach breaks on the whole coast. It's black sand and shore breaks and reef breaks and like tricky conditions. So there's one wave in particular that breaks like multiple times a week year round, and it's like a 200 meter long sick right point break. So it's kind of like the heart of the Icelandic surf community, really.
Like the crescent head of almost the East Coast, so to speak.
Yeah, it's like a North Coast point break.
Yeah, wow.
You know, and it's in that, like, you can go there as an experienced surfer, have a great time. You can go there as a beginner and have a great time.
Yeah, sick.
So, you know, it's kind of like the center of everything, and it's half an hour from the city where most people live. So, sure, you can drive 5 hours through the snow to chase a wave on a far-flung corner of the island, but that's not something you're going to do every week.
For sure. So this is the go-to, this is the jewel of the coast, so to speak, because of the accessibility and the reliability of the wave.
Totally. And so the whole thing is that there's the town that this wave's in, they want to do a landfill project, like a rock fill, that goes over the top of the wave.
And why do they want to do that?
Well, it's a good question. But essentially, this wave breaks on the edge of their harbour, on the southern breakwall extremity of their harbour, and a certain individual who has a mining interest in the area and needs to store material by the harbour needs new land to store his material. So
sounds like the age-old situation, Wally, and I'm sure he's been getting up into the politicians' grills and making sure that his money is thrown around to get what he wants.
I mean, people say that he put the politicians that run this town in power, and that seems to be how it works, because they're the ones making this happen.
Seems like it works around the world, globally, like that. Consistently.
Yeah, I think we've seen this story before somewhere.
Yeah, I think it happens a lot in Australia also.
Yeah, not the first time, nor will it be the last.
Lobbyists, eh?
Yeah.
Those dirty dogs!
But small town, Iceland, you know, it's a wild thing. You know, there are a select few people that run the show. Anyone that stands against those people, that speaks out against them, well, suddenly the threat of, okay, we're going to take away your job or take away that contract. You know, it's a real thing. And in small places where there's not a huge amount of opportunity, you know, there's a lot of leverage over people, keeping people in line. So in this case, this particular project, the destruction of the wave, you know, there are lifelong surfers that live in this town that have been silenced, that are too afraid to speak up against this.
Silenced because themselves and their families will be diminished, so to speak.
I mean, imagine if the guy that owns all the property, all the business, everything in the town shows up on your door and says, you and your family will never work in this town again.
Yeah.
Straight up.
Yeah, it's pretty heavy.
You go, well, is it worth it?
For sure.
You know, it's real.
And so what are you guys doing at the moment to stop this ridiculous project?
I think as an Australian, you know, you come in and you just go, this is a bit insane. And the more and more I came to understand the relationship and the history with the ocean, I get it.
And they must be loving you being an outsider coming in and being like in front of this campaign.
Yeah, well, look, I think I come with love, you know, in a way. I'm not here to tell them, like, okay, this is how you have to do it.
And but you got a bit of backbone, mate.
I mean, you got a
backbone.
Sometimes you got to tell them.
Yeah, but you got to tell them.
I don't think it's not my place to tell them how they run their show. If they hear all the facts and they choose to cover this wave in rocks, well, at the end of the day, it's a lost... Like, in my opinion, it is theft from the Icelandic people and the Icelandic community.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a public community resource, and in Iceland they spend ridiculous money creating sporting, like, indoor heated sporting fields so that people can play football or whatever. The, you know, they build these facilities that cost so much money in dollar terms. Here you have a surf break that breaks most of the year. It requires no maintenance. It's perfect. And they're about to cover it in rocks.
Yeah, like, because of one man's interest.
It's benefiting the few and not the many.
For sure.
And I think in a country where people don't necessarily appreciate the opportunities attached to building a surf culture, you know, it's just a foreign concept. What we have in Australia in all our coastal towns, the people in, if any town in Iceland was going to be the surf town, it would be this place. But these people don't actually know because they haven't been exposed to it. You know, it's not they don't care or they don't want it. They just haven't seen it.
And I guess also, too, from a tourism factor, and I'm just thinking about dollar signs here, you know, a lot of the waves around the world, like, will draw in a crowd that will then flow back into small businesses around the area with the cafes, restaurants, hotels. Tourism industry will be pumped up. You've then got the creative arts industry when you've got videographers and photographers and you've got all those sort of people getting a slice of the pie. It sounds like here in Iceland, again, with not knowing much about the wave or the place, that's not the case and they don't see as much benefit from keeping that wave. Would I be right?
Yeah, I mean, I think our media campaign and the whole project around it was just about showing people what they have in their backyard.
Yeah.
And obviously surfers, they already get it. But in the broader population there, there are so many skiers, hikers, fishermen, just people that are passionate about the Icelandic nature. And they don't they didn't know that Iceland had a world-class wave, you know, half an hour from the city. They just thought, well, if that wave disappears, you go and paddle out a few hundred meters away. You know, these little details that we all take for granted were just are not broadly known in the community over there. So they can't protect what they don't understand.
Of course. And so with your campaign and you leading the campaign, obviously in this cinematic effect, like what was the angle you were really going for and how did you deliver that campaign?
I mean, we really just want to show people like the possibilities of not only what an amazing thing they already have, you know, this isn't something that just foreigners come and enjoy. There is a whole Icelandic surf community. And, you know, someone asked at a screening we did in the Westfjords of Iceland the other day, someone asked me and they said, so, you know, as a surfer, how do you feel? And I think my friends in Australia all laugh at me a little bit that I'm here on the other side of the world pushing the virtues of surfing, like encouraging people to surf, you know, after a whole life spent here in Australia trying to go as far away from people and go to remote places and keep things on the down low,
mm-hmm.
You know, ironic for a photographer. But after that, to now be in the other corner of the world and pushing this thing, going, you guys need to care about this. You need to build this up. You need to lift this thing. And I think I just look at it like the Icelandic community deserve the opportunity to experience this. And if they choose to grow this and now and in the future, you know, I think it's cruel to take that away from the community there. And as an Australian, you know what that can be. You know, I know the experiences I've been given in my life from being able to grow up by the beach, by a fun wave, and to travel around and do that.
For sure.
And so I just think if that was taken away from Icelanders, I just think that would be a terrible thing.
And it's almost like they don't know what they have until it's gone and until it's too late. And then you take that away from them. And they're such, you know, geared individuals when it comes to, you know, outdoor adventure. They love their extreme sports when it comes to skiing or rock climbing or, you know, I'm sure even cold water immersion.
Yeah.
Motherfuckers are onto it, especially the saunas. They know what's going on in the Scandies. But yeah, it's interesting to see that yourself, you know, with the ethos of just immersing yourself in nature and living your whole life vicariously through that sort of that sort of
catchphrase, you know, kind of whatever it is. Like, it's just interesting to see yourself. You find yourself there now, Steve, you know, at that time when that needs to occur, and it's almost like a calling, so to speak.
I mean, I think it's very, it is as meaningful as anything I've done, really. Like, I think facilitating people's connection with the natural world, you know, I think that's so important. And that's a layer of the filmmaking and the creative process that, you know, not all elements of that are rewarding. You know, you can do all these things to make money, but at the end of the day, you know, are you, like, what are you really contributing back to the community? So to be living in another country and to be able to try and help with something like this, to try and share this gift that I've been lucky enough to experience with them, you know, that feels like a good way to spend my time.
For sure.
And, you know, to create this film that we've made and create an event with hundreds of people showing up and making a splash across TV and radio and the whole community in Iceland, and hopefully to influence things for the better. Yeah, look, I'm pretty proud of that. And yeah, it is a bit weird to be in this situation in a country that I'd never been to, you know, a year and a half ago.
But it also shows your calling to nature and how you lived your whole life and how your photography and cinematography started within bodyboarding and, you know, going abroad, and now you've just encapsulated that with your everyday movements in life. It's incredible. Well, what's the name of the movie so people can look it up?
It's called Aldon Oka Atra, which so we made the film in Icelandic.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, I'm learning Icelandic, but that was not an easy process.
Must be a tough tongue to master.
I mean, it's a dialogue driven documentary with some of the best people in Iceland speaking.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so I was lucky to have Berglin, my partner, that helped me
translate.
Co-creator of the film as well. Big shout out.
Yeah, Berglin.
Berglin, big ups. Yeah, so we premiered this film a few weeks ago in Reykjavik, and we're about to premiere it in the small town where the wave is. The film is under wraps still because it was created for the people of that town.
You know,
some projects, I guess, take an issue and they take it to the whole wide world. We went the opposite way and went full local level on it.
Because, I think the Scandies would appreciate that.
I mean, if I made a film in English with a bunch of people telling them what to do in their town,
they'd be off it.
It's not the right way to do it.
No way. You got to come from the heart. You got to come from the local community.
Yeah. And I think it's coming at it with empathy, and, you know, there's no shaming and rock throwing in all of this. You know, it is acknowledging there's just a very real cultural difference there. And I guess it's just posing the question, you know, is this something that the Icelanders want to see in their society long term?
Will this come out on YouTube, or will this come out on
this platform? Will come out online eventually.
Yeah Will it be translated with subtitles?
It's got English subtitles,
thank fuck.
Yeah.
So I cannot be learning the OG Viking.
No, it'd take you a while,
wouldn't it? Yeah, I can't imagine, man.
Yeah,
so that's a different tongue.
That has kind of really spiked an interest, I guess, in understanding a place where the whole basis of their relationship in the ocean is there's so much trauma, there's so much loss, like you were saying. You know, this isn't people lost their great-great-grandfathers 200 years ago. This is people that have lost their friends and their fathers and their uncles and people close to them, you know, not long ago. So the ocean is like a really treacherous, it's a fearsome place, and, you know, the ocean up there is gnarly.
Yeah.
Make no mistake of it. So it's been this place where people have gone to battle to provide for so many years, and that defines people's relationship with the ocean, and I really hope that moving forward that can be a more positive one. And if I can do anything to that with what I do with my camera and the ocean and all of that, then I will be stoked.
I think you have done it already, man. Sally, you've made a huge impact. And I know you've got a ridiculous tennis game to play that you need to make a huge impact with that too. You know? Not so much ridiculous with the tennis game, but I know you're going to be putting pressure on a lot of Northern Beaches pros over there. So I don't want to hold you up for too much longer, but, man, I want to thank you so much for coming on the potty. We've covered so much ground, and we've just talked about a wide range of things that I probably wouldn't normally talk about. So it's been really enthralling. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having us, Lukey. We will have to do it again and dribble for as long as we want to dribble.
Fucking oath. I'd love to, man. Yeah, for sure. When you're back in Australia, I know you've got a big trip across Oz pretty soon with the chick. So it'd be great to follow your travels there. And when you're back in Oz, maybe come Christmas time, we'll have to catch up.
We'll debrief.
Fucking oath, Wally. Cheers, bro.
All right, man.
You.
Yeah.
Nice, good yarn.
Great yarn, quality yarn, bruh. That was sick.
I feel like we're just getting started.
I know, you could keep going, but I know, like, you've got somewhere to be, and also, too, I can hear my groms down there, and they'd be going
crazy. Yeah. The realities of life, eh?
Yeah, for sure, but that was sick, man. That was fucking epic. You
can always come back and go into whatever.
Yeah. Oh, man, we covered so much cool stuff there. Yeah. That was really sick.
Yeah, I can't really think of... Yeah. Good philosophical chat about boot culture and where it went.
I know. I really want to talk about that because, yeah, it was such a pivotal time, you coming up, and then the whole, you know, GFC vibes and the BFC.
BFC.
As Drag would coin it.
Yeah.
That was pretty hectic. But, yeah, it's sick to see that it's still carried on in other parts of life.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah. It was all a part.